This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarterbin. In every episode of this podcast, I'll summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue from my comic book collection, which I will select sort of at random. Any book from my comic book collection is eligible, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. Was the issue worth 25 cents? Was it a bargain at 25 cents? Or was it still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 50th episode of the Quarterbin Podcast, we're looking at a book that sums up everything about the Quarterbins. It's pretty much the reason we have Quarterbins. Yes, for this special episode, we're looking at the quintessential Quarterbin book, Turok Dinosaur Hunter, number one, from Valiant Comics, cover dated July 1993. Now, usually when I say we are covering book, I'm referring to myself and my massive ego. But this time, to mark the 50th episode and to help me dissect this book and its effect on the hobby and business of comics, I've asked some of my favorite podcasting buddies to help. Now, this book was so overhyped that it had a ruinous effect on the comics industry, some argued. And when I think of overhyped and ruinous, I think of these guys. Wait, that might not have come out right. Anyway, joining me on this epic, epic journey, our fellow educator and fan of Eddie and the Cruisers, from the pop culture affidavit website and podcast, Tom Panarese.
Overhyped? I would just like to be underhyped.
Hyped at all.
Or hyped at all.
And from a whole bunch of podcasts on the Comic Book Noise Network, and from the state just next door to mine, he's wild, wonderful Ed Moore.
Howdy.
Good to have you here, Ed. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
Welcome to Relatively Geeky.
Thank you.
Glad to have you. And you would think that would be enough, but no. This book is so Quarterbinerific, we had to call in more help. From Back to the Bins, the producer himself, and let's be honest, if you've ever listened to that show, the brains of the operation, New York's own Paul Spataro.
And let's make no mistake about it, I am every bit as large as your ego.
Trust me, right now, Ed is thinking the exact same thing. It's nice every once in a while to podcast with a bunch of people who aren't in your family. Is that right?
It is different, yes.
Well, we are glad.
Are we all one big family, though, aren't we, really?
There you go.
Absolutely.
Comic book podcast of fear.
Thanks for having us all on, Alan.
Yeah, this is going
to
be fun.
Let's do it. Glad to have everyone joining me for this. Now, first thing I want to start with is your collecting and reading histories in terms of this era, you know, from comics in the big picture or the sort of this wave of the indie boom or Valiant books, even Turok himself, if you have a history with this specific book. And I'll start. Now, I had gone back to grad school in 1990, and my future podcasting partner, Emily, was born in 1991. So my collecting years were pretty much winding down based on, you know, family budget cuts in general growing up. So I had reduced my purchasing dramatically and was mostly out by this point, with just a few notable exceptions. I was collecting whatever titles I was just until they got to a good round number, like 50 or 100 or something like that. It's the accountant in me, I think. And then I just, you know, canceled them at that point. So the only book I remember starting in the early 90s that I did get hyped into was Spawn. And I confess to still kind of liking a lot of those early issues. I jumped into the Techno comic books, which were like 95. So I was fortunate in some ways to miss out on a lot of the boom and bust. I was largely out. I don't recall the Valiant hype at all. And it really wasn't until returning to comics in the mid-2000s that I heard about the legendary status of this book. So stories of discount bins filled with copies of Turok Dinosaur Hunter number one, for example. So when I saw this one in a quarter bin, I knew I had to pick it up. And that's why we're here. So I'm curious about what your experiences were during this era and with this book in particular. Paul, start with you.
My experiences with this book began when you sent it to me. So I'm not going to be able to give you too much on the book itself. It's funny because it has become the butt of a little bit of a joke on Back to the Bins. Particularly Mike Bailey brings it up frequently as a book that we're going to cover over and over and over again. And surprisingly enough, we haven't covered it, so it's interesting or ironic that we're covering it here now after all this time. But my comic collecting, and you know, as we were joking around about, I'm a little older than you guys. Not that much older than you, but a lot older than Tom.
We're all a lot older than Tom.
Around 1986, I think it was, when I was about 23, 24 years old, I went cold turkey. I decided I'm too old to collect comics and I'm not going to do it anymore, which life has shown me that was a false thought. But I had totally gotten out of it. I discontinued my bag at the local comic store and I stopped buying any new books and I really wasn't following the hobby at all. And then in the early 90s, I started to work in Manhattan and they would have street vendors who would be selling books, you know, cheap. So it's almost like the boom of the 90s didn't exist at all. Like there was never the speculator market for me because right off the bat, you know, there were quarter and 50 cent bins right on the street that you could walk by. And that kind of pulled me back in a little bit.
These books you were buying, sorry to interrupt, did they have covers on them? Or were you buying the, yeah. Okay, just check.
No, they were basically, they were overpurchased late 80s, early 90s books that they just had, you know, an excess stock of. And they were selling them, you know, four for a dollar, 10 for $5, whatever it was. And I started picking up a little bit. And they had The Death of Superman, which was incredibly hyped. And I got pulled into that. And the next thing I knew, I was buying comics again. But even with all of that, I still primarily always been a Marvel to a most degree and then to a smaller degree DC. But I had never really jumped both feet into the independent market. So I kind of never really got into Valiant all that much. It was more word of mouth that I heard about it than actually read anything back then.
See, for me, in the late 80s or mid to late 80s, I was buying some independents. You know, I mean, this was the era of black and white independents. Mm-hmm. So I would have been a prime target for this type of book if I had been in. What's your experience, Ed Moore?
Up until this point, starting in the mid to late 70s, I was just unabashedly a Marvel zombie, primarily because that's what my dad read. And so I guess I almost had hand-me-down comics from my dad because I got to read all of them too after he did. But oddly enough, sitting here thinking back, and I try not to think back about the early 90s and my comic book experience too much.
Consider this group therapy, Ed. Group therapy.
I was the problem. It worked on me. Almost entirely my experience up to that point had been Marvel. Then word started getting out about all of my favorite Marvel creators leaving. So that immediately piqued my interest because I was very much into the X books at the time. And a lot of those creators are who ultimately became Image's first generation of creators. That whole early to middle 90s thing that comic books went through, it went through because of me. I bought those books. And Turok was one of those books that they did the right things at the right time and it captured my interest. And that is why I had a copy when this came about.
Now, Paul, how did you get this particular comic? Then we'll get back to Ed's story.
Well, I was lucky enough to have a benefactor who would mail it to me.
Yes.
I don't want to embarrass the person because he spent almost 10 times the amount that the book cost to mail it to me.
Well, here's the thing. Let's just say the copy that I'm looking at is not the only one I've ever seen in quarter bins. I've been planning this episode for a while, so I had a few extras lying around. Let's just put it that way. The fact that Ed said I wouldn't have to send him one, A, you know, it made him so far my favorite guest, and two, he has a story to tell. So get picking up there, Ed.
Okay.
Causing the downfall of the industry. Just pick up there.
Yes. I'll put that on my back and we'll run with that right there on my back. I also, oddly enough, was in graduate school, and I had not gotten to the point where kids were in the picture, but it was coming about 4 or 5 years down the road. So I had a little discretionary income. The comic shop that I used, unfortunately, was about a block and a half from where my graduate assistant teaching job was. So it was a quick in and out at lunch, and I was able to get my fix of early 90s, mainly Image at this time. They were really pulling me away from Marvel. But the aforementioned Death of Superman, I also fell victim to. I bought my share of bagged issues. That was speculating, though, honestly. I didn't care what happened to Superman, but I thought I could make some money.
You ended up putting Nick through college with that, right?
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. I sold those bagged Supermans. Turok was all of those Valiant titles as they were coming out were being marketed with all of the typical cover and book options of the time. Foil covers, hollow covers, embossed, embroiled, embargoed, whatever they could do to make them sound cooler. And it worked on me. I don't know if I should be ashamed of that or not, but it did. I had a pull list, but also the comic shop that I went to in Huntington. This was in Huntington, West Virginia. I don't know if I said that. Marshall University, for those that know their college athletics a little bit. And the store was owned and operated by a woman, and she was the only one that ever worked there. So that was my first experience with a female-run comic shop, which, not to my experience, but apparently that was a rarity. So she would take all of the books that came out, and she would have them stacked up, each individual title, so that as you walked through the store, on top of the boxes of back issues was everything that came in. So I would walk through those, pick out the interesting ones, and then go on up to the counter and get the ones that she had pulled as per my list. And Turok was one of the ones that I grabbed off the boxes because I pretty much stuck with my pull list with those things I definitely knew. But all of these up-and-coming flashy kind of things, they caught my eye as I walked in. And that's how I bought most of those first issues for those 90s books. So even more so, it was my fault because I didn't even intend to buy them. They were all impulse purchases.
So when you say eye-catching, that is definitely what some of these foil, holographic, mumbo-jumbo, glow-in-the-dark neon covers, they were designed to do.
And I thought, and I still think, that if that's what you're looking for in a comic book, it was very effective. But that is how I acquired my current copy of Turok, and I have grown and pared my comic collection several times since then. But this has always been one of those books that just kind of hung around, and I truly think it's because I just think the cover is darn cool.
Well, we will get to that shortly.
So there's my Turok story.
Now for the young kid, Tom Panarese.
I actually started seriously collecting comics in 1990. I had a very brief run of collecting, maybe in the summer of 87, I think it was, because my friends and I were buying G.I. Joe and the Transformers from the comic store. And I do remember, for whatever reason, that summer picking up Kraven's Last Hunt, but it didn't stick. And then my friends and I, a couple of friends and I of mine, started buying Batman comics after the Tim Burton film came out in 89. And I was kind of reading along with them here and there, and then decided probably about like maybe, oh, May or June of 1990, went up to the comic book store that was in my hometown, which was not very far from my parents' house, just right up the street, and plunked down money for, I think it was the latest issue of Detective Comics. And so I've and since then have been mainly a DC guy. Had a little bit of I went through my X-Men phase right around the time that Jim Lee left and stayed on there for about a year or two afterward. The first indie comic company I actually got into was actually Dark Horse, mainly because of the Aliens and Predator comics, because I was I'm still a huge fan of the movie Aliens. And so that first, I have the first three Aliens series in trade, in the original trade, before they decided to redo the like kind of special edition of the series because of continuity in Alien 3, which is another discussion for another day. But I fell prey to Image. A friend of mine who I went to school with, and then he moved away, and we kept in touch when he moved to Florida. He got really into X-Men, and I was reading Batman and sometimes Superman if the story entertained me, and the Titans, the Teen Titans. At that time, they were the New Titans. And he was sending me like stuff on what's going on with X-Men, and then he gave me a copy of Spawn number one. I stuck with Spawn, I want to say, till about maybe issue 60. Other Image titles, much, much less. I had Wildcats for a little while, and it panned out in so much as when I started to kind of run out of money to buy all these books from month to month, I started to scale back, especially as the story quality got worse and worse. And not only that, you had more and more Image books coming out with covers like, my all-time favorite gimmick cover was Bloodstrike number one, which looked like it had been splattered with blood, and you could feel it, and you could feel the blood on the cover. So stupid. But as those things were coming out, you also had I did collect all of the death of Superman, Doomsday, Funeral for a Friend, and Return of Superman, that whole thing, and I read it all the way through. The big event for me was Nightfall, Night Quest, and Night's End in the Bat books, which came out, which was slightly after the death of Superman. They kind of coincided, but Nightfall started a little bit later. But that ended up being a lot of money because you were basically reading four Batman titles, one of which, Shadow of the Bat, was a deluxe. I think they called it deluxe format. It was a more expensive book. It was as opposed to being a dollar book, it was a $1.75 book or whatever the price ranges were. I might be off by like, you know, a quarter or so.
$1.75 for a new book. What a ripoff.
Yeah, well, that's what Titans was when I started buying it. And Dark Horse's books were $2.50 when I started collecting comics. And all of Image's books were $1.95. So these things really were adding up. And that's the one disappointment I have about all that is that I had to drop the Ultraverse pretty quickly, mainly because of just financial priorities, like, you know, kind of paring down my pull list of what books I had. And I'd say girls, but I'd be lying.
We're comic book guys. We understand that stuff.
Yeah. But long story short, like, I was actually because I was 13 in 1990. And in 1985, after the comic book industry was pretty much completely in the crapper, I headed off to college. So by then, I was really only buying the books that I could afford because I was now a broke college student. But in that time, I was almost like the perfect – I was in the target audience for all of this. I was a teenage boy who saw things like, you know, the pretty women that Image was putting on their covers and things like that. And that was supposed to be enticing. I read Wizard on a regular basis, so I knew of Valiant. I also have all of Deathmate, which is something else we could talk about later if you want to.
I mean, but, while we're doing confession time, that might be the
yeah. But I never picked up Turok because it was I don't know if I saw through the hype or I just didn't have the money, because the comics were available, and Wizard, hyped up Valiant. Wizard kept kind of putting Valiant out as like, you know, this is the comic, these comics are the good comics that you want to buy. And I had a couple of, I think I had like one or two issues of, it might have been Exo Manowar was the one title I gave a shot for like a couple of months. But I just, for whatever reason that's lost to, you know, memory, I don't know why I just never bought into Valiant as much as I did Image. And I know I bought into Image because of the names attached to it, but it's, I don't know. It might've been, I was just a little too late and the bloom had already been started to go off the rose on Valiant by the time I, you know, bought a couple of comics here and there or what, but yeah, I have very, very vivid memories of a lot of what was going on in the market at the time in the early 90s. And I honestly did not hear about how badly received and this legend of Turok the Dinosaur Hunter number one was until I actually heard, I think I heard Michael Bailey tell one of those stories about people just throwing away long boxes worth of this thing.
That was on Back to the Bins. He's told that story.
Yeah. And so I did pay a little more than a quarter for this. I'm pretty sure I fished it out of a 50-cent box at my local comic shop. But I know. But I will tell you that I went up to the counter and he looked at the cover and he went, "Ooh, chromium." That's exact words. And I looked straight at it. I said, "You know, you have a dozen of these." He was like, "Yeah." So
yeah, every store does.
Well, and my comic guy, every once in a while, will get somebody coming into the store with a stack of comics from the 90s. And he tells him to do eBay because it's like, you know, he just can gesture to the permanent quarter bins and be like, you know, they're all in there already. So.
All right, guys. Well, I appreciate you coming clean about your collecting histories. And, you know, Tom, it's been more than 20 years and I'm just barely able to admit that I kind of liked Spawn. I've got to admit, I kind of liked it. I haven't read it in quite some time, but I'm not ashamed of that one. Somehow I've decided to come out of the closet as a fan of the first couple dozen issues or
something. Yeah, the first couple dozen issues were decent, but then it got, even though I was reading month to month, I remember that book being very hard to follow at one point.
Yeah.
And it got very convoluted, and I got a decent amount of money for the issues that I had though on eBay, so I'm not gonna
timing is everything.
Oh yeah.
Well, let's move on to talking about this masterpiece. Turok, Dinosaur Hunter number one, had a cover price of $3.50. I acquired this book at just over a 92% discount. And if you factor in buying two and sending one to Paul, it's still about $3.50 total. So that's not so bad. The cover, by Bart Sears and Randy Elliott, has an embossed picture in the middle of the cover, showing our hero, a vaguely Native American-looking dude, shirtless, with some feathers and a holster, and he's standing on top of an overturned red car, his bow fully pulled back, preparing to shoot down into a pack of a half dozen snakes, I guess, and the snakes are kind of bedazzled. I mean, those guys are definitely blinged up. The story, titled Cold Blood Blazing, was written by David Michelinie, with art by Bart Sears and Randy Elliott, and we start with 7 pages of narrative flashback recap. Turok and his buddy Andar are hunting in the 1800s north of the Rio Grande, which puts them around the Texas-Mexico border, and they walk through a mystical cave and find the Lost Lands, filled with dinosaurs, and natives, who of course make Turok and Andar their leaders, because that's what we do when strangers from a land we've never heard of arrive. We make them our leaders. Then we get some appearances by other Valiant characters, I guess, because there are strange time warps and everything. And things don't go well for Turok, as
technologically enhanced monsters had butchered my adopted tribe, every man, woman, and child. The leader among these ultra-evolved dinosaurs was Mon Arc. And Turok tracked he and his mate and was preparing to wreak revenge when he is warped to the late 1980s, where our story actually starts. And we learn that his mortal enemy, Mon Arc, is there as well. Mon Arc and his lady companion, dinosaur wife, attack Turok, who is only armed with one of Mother God's special technical super bow, and I presume super arrows. He wonders just how many of the monsters have followed him. I'll never know. Wounded by the battle, Turok is pushed off a cliff by the dinosaurs and supposedly falls to his death. That takes us about halfway through the book, fellas, so let's talk first off about the cover. Ed, you mentioned the cover. What was it about this cover? I mean, it is pretty cool, actually.
I mean, just look at that. Compared to the... Now, you know, also keep in mind that all of these books, maybe including the Death of Superman titles, but I don't quite recall, everything else was still pretty much being printed on newsprint.
Right.
Very thin covers. Anyone that collects comics has seen books from the late 80s or early 90s that were not like this. But I mean, compared to that, look at this cover. Tell me that's not going to catch your eye.
Like a disco ball.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's shiny.
I don't know what that's called with having that picture. Like, it's like a cutout from another book that's been like pasted to the cover of this one.
Is that what they called chromium?
I think the chromium is kind of the silverish.
Yeah.
Okay. I was trying to figure out a way to describe that. Yeah, it's like a cutout that's about half the size of the cover. That's inset, or not even inset, that is attached. You know, if you feel around, it's glued to the top of it. And it's almost, you know, photo quality paper on top of an already pretty thick cover.
Almost like a book plate.
Right.
Yeah. That you would find in older books. And it was just so, you know, any number of reasons. The cover was shiny. It had the bright, bold colors. And it had this other picture seemingly just glued to the top of it. nice foil looking title, Turok Dinosaur Hunter in blazing yellow and red color. Come on. I mean, ooh, shiny. What else can you say?
Well, let's not discount the rest of the cover too, because it's also got the I don't know exactly what the terminology would be, but it's not flat. It's got the image pushed into it.
Yeah, it's an embossed cardstock cover.
Okay. Yeah.
And you're right, you didn't these types of covers, embossed or not, the cardstock covers were used for the big kind of hyped books, like you mentioned Death of Superman. I never actually opened a bad copy of Superman 75, but I don't think it was a cardstock cover. But Adventures of Superman 500, the direct market edition, had it. And then when the four issues that introduced each of the Supermen for the beginning of Reign of the Superman, they had a cardstock cover, except there was like a cutout, and you opened it up, and then the full image was in the inside because the cutout was a S-Shield diamond. So, but yeah, this cardstock is one of the reasons why the price was a little higher than usual. But yeah, but this is an embossing that they would do from time to time, too. Batman 500 is a lot like this.
This type of cover, the stock, G.I. Joe 1 had this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was very, from Marvel and DC, it was just very, very special issues that they would do it. But yet, at this time, more and more of these other companies, Image, Valiant, a couple other companies, were coming out with these almost as standard for their books.
Yeah, and Image and Valiant and Dark Horse were printing on better paper from the beginning. And this was around the time that Marvel and DC actually switched to better paper. And I think one of the reasons Marvel and DC kept with the old paper so much is probably because they just had a ton of it because they've been using it for so many years.
Yeah,
or they
you know, must have had some long-term contract.
Yeah,
acquire it at a locked-in price or something.
Yeah, so yeah. Image Valiant were not under that sort of didn't have that problem. They could do this if they wanted to.
Yeah, poor Marvel and DC were getting the books produced at a lower price, and mm-hmm. and they weren't able to jack up the price because of doing this quite as quickly as the other places were.
Yeah, I know.
It's a pretty cover. I look at it, and it really is pretty, and it's eye-catching, and it serves its purposes. But it is what was wrong with that era, and continues to be wrong to some extent to date. They try to gimmick you into buying books, and they try to gimmick people into buying large quantities of book. And going back to what you said earlier, Ed, when you were saying basically, yeah, I was the problem then, I don't think you were. I think the people who were the problem were the ones who were buying 4 and 5 copies of these things, thinking that they were going to make huge money off them. Right. I think I was part of the problem when I bought 2 copies of Superman 75 because I needed to leave one in the bag, but I also needed to open one so that I could read it.
Right.
Yeah, that's what I think the problem
is. Speculating, I guess, is, yeah.
In the very least with this cover, you can see the image. There were embossed covers on cardstock in the 90s where it would just be kind of – there would be no drawing. It was just like, you know, here's the Avengers, and like if you hold it up to the light, you can see the imprint of the Avengers in it. It felt like you were getting ripped off in some way or another because it wasn't as cool. As, I mean, at least this is a – it's a – I'm not the hugest fan of Bart Sears' art, and we can – I'll get into a little bit more of that later, but at least this cover is pretty well composed. You know, he's very center of the image. He's in a pose that is not anatomically impossible.
That's again, a step up from the 90s right there.
Yeah. He's also not a woman. He's not wearing, like, you know, there's no crazy amount of gadgetry going on here. So it's a decent picture. So in the very least, I think that's what that in a positive side, that's what makes it an attractive cover. In addition to all of the bells and whistles, if this were your regular flat, if this were like, say, the newsstand edition, which is what DC and Marvel still were putting out at this time, and it was just a flat image with this still would have looked halfway attractive on a newsstand.
And also, let's not sell DC and Marvel short on raking the customers through the coals either, because they started the Baxter paper thing way earlier than
that. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The direct.
That was their direct market in, books. Yeah.
And they did it on Legion. They did it on Titans. They did it on Infinity Incorporated, I think.
And with
the Omega Men.
And with Titans and Legion, and then didn't they reprint those like a year later?
Titans turned into Tales of the Titans.
Yes.
And then they came out with the Baxter edition. For a year, they produced new stories in the Tales book, and then when they were a year old, they started reprinting Baxter paper books in there.
Yeah, and the reprints, at least of Titans, I don't know about Legion, but the reprints of Titans lasted. So they started at issue 60, and I think that went to issue 91. So that actually lasted a couple of years. Yeah.
Well, that was before the direct market was really. You know, totally accessible to a lot of people. I mean, I've had local comic book stores since the early 70s when I started buying comics. It's not like I didn't have comic book stores around, but I didn't have access to the new newsstand books probably until the early 80s. Mm-hmm. Those, you know, I either got them on the newsstand or I got them in the back issue bins. In the comic store, but the comic stores didn't have, you know, they didn't have a pull list for you until the 80s.
I worked the newsstand and comic store thing to my advantage, though, because there were two, you know what I'm talking about when I talk about stationery stores, were in my town, and the newsstand books would always be on their racks a little longer than in the comic shop. So if I missed an issue of something, or if I came in on late on something, I could probably go into the stationery stores and find it there. But by the time I was collecting, pull lists were a pretty regular thing among a lot of other things that we have now.
Now, I had one practical issue I had with the cover is it made the book really hard to read. because of how thick the cover is and where that you know, I don't know, photo, you know, almost that image is attached to it, that cover does not bend. And I had a hard time, I mean, literally holding it and trying to bend to, you know, it was a very unusual reading experience in trying to flip back, and because that you know, we're so used to that front cover having a little give to it. I'm a picky almost 50-year-old at this point, so what can I say? Just to sort of general thoughts on the first, you know, half or so of the story.
Columbia is spelled Columbia.
You noticed that too, Mr. English teacher.
Yeah.
No, this is a different place. This is Columbia.
Yeah, this is the District of Columbia.
Oh, the district. It's Columbia, South Carolina.
Yeah. Yes.
Sorry.
So who's the editor on this book? That would be
Bob Layton.
It is no. According, if you go to the very last page of the story, Bob Layton is also the editor on the book.
Oh, okay. Well, doesn't that fall in his lap?
Between that or the letterer, someone.
Yes.
Someone,
well, the letterer is the one who made the error, but isn't the right editor supposed to catch that error?
We're not off to a great start, Tom. Is that what you're getting at? The first word is literally a typo.
Yeah.
I mean, we certainly had a lot of. I mean, this was, as I said, about 6 or 7 pages of pure narration here. And I guess there are references to prior events that were going on in Valiant.
Turok was, I don't even remember which company, whether it was Charlton or
Key,
something
maybe,
else. But Turok had been around since the 60s, correct?
I think before that.
I'm wondering if this story, as retold here, is somewhat true to his prior incarnations, and then just tweaked a little bit to add in the Valiant characters.
The little bit of poking around I did, I think, put it in the 1950s. I found some Gold Key comics from the 50s, Turok, Son of Stone, which at least had Turok and Andar as the main characters. But I did not dig much more than that. But my impression is there are some, yeah, Magnus and some of the other folks who are in those first 6 or 7 pages.
Well, yeah, he mentions the mother god, she appeared, her palace appeared in flashlight from heaven, and she sought unity. And I know unity was the sort of big, we're going to start the Valiant universe up crossover that happened like when the line began. So I think that's where the tie-in comes.
If I recall, Turok was a later entrant in that early portion of Valiant, if that makes sense.
Yeah, flipping through the back of the book, some of the other titles are in their late teens or 20s.
Yeah, I definitely remember Magnus and Solar coming out quite a bit.
Yeah,
prior
two
to
full
this
years before this.
Yeah, so I also bought those, but off the top of my head, I don't recall who else might have been coming out making a core of Valiant this time, other than those two.
Well, there's a checklist at the back. You got Archer and Armstrong, Bloodshot, Eternal Warrior, Harbinger, Hardcore, Magnus Robot Fighter, Rye and the Future Force, Shadow Man, Solar, and Exo Man of War. And of all of those, the lowest issue number is number 6 on Bloodshot. And so everything, you know, they had all been around, I guess, for at least half a year before this one came.
Rye and the Future Force was originally just Rye.
Rye.
And I think the 0 issue was one of those, like, crazy priced wizard magazine books, you know. And Turok's first appearance, at least in Valiant, was Magnus number 12.
No, I know Magnus was also a character from the 60s or 50s.
Yeah.
Yeah, via Gold Key.
Okay.
All right, and that's what he was.
Turok had a slight career under Dell also. I suspect that would have been before Charlton got a hold of him.
Yeah, it could be.
Or not Charlton, Gold Key.
Gold Key, sorry. I know there was a Solar Man of the Atom graphic novel that I picked up cheap.
Less than 25 cents?
Okay, not that cheap.
I think Tom and I might disagree just from what he said earlier, but I kind of like the artwork in this first issue. I was going to say the first seven pages, but I kind of like the whole thing artwork-wise.
I think Bart Sears draws a good action sequence. I've just never liked the way he draws faces.
I'm looking at this, and I'm thinking from this story and from the ads in this book, it looks to me like that Valiant decided to adopt a house style of, hey, can you draw like John Byrne? I mean, I'm seeing it, like I said, not only in this book, but in ads here, this hotshot core, or hardcore, rather, excuse me, in particular, that ad looks very John Byrne-ish. That's by Mike Leake. And you got to figure, at this point in time, John Byrne would have been kind of a comics icon. But, I find the artwork to be fairly acceptable. Yeah, the faces are a little hard, but really you're only seeing Turok, who's supposed to be a, you know, hardened warrior, and then a bunch of dinosaurs. You're really not seeing a lot of faces here.
Ed, his art in this is actually not bad compared to when he did prior to this, did I Justice League Europe. That could be hit or miss depending on, you know, who he was drawing in that, you know. But for somebody to be kind of the superstar recognizable talent on a high profile book for a company like Valiant like this is actually not a bad choice. Sears had been doing so many covers for Wizard by this point that he was a name. Valiant was not known for having name artists at this point. I think the biggest name associated with Valiant up until this point is probably Jim Shooter.
Because it has Bob Layton as the editor-in-chief, and I'm familiar with Jim Shooter as being the driving force behind Valiant. What was his role around this time, do you know?
Shooter is not listed in the back on the Valiant letterhead.
I think he'd been fired by this point.
Yeah, he might have been on his way to creating the...
Defiant.
Right. Yes.
That's right.
Yeah, he might have already been on his way out at this point.
He got fired from Marvel, or you listen to him, he left. He tried to buy the company at one point after that, because then I think New World outbid them. I'm trying to remember this off the top of my head. And then he went on to found Valiant, and then got either ousted or left, depending on who you believe. And then you're right, he went on to Defiant, and there were a couple of other, like, every time he turned around, he was in the 90s, he was trying to start up another comics company that was just, right. None of them really went anywhere.
Well, that seems like an excellent place to take a little break. We're going to drop in a promo or two right here, and when we come back, we will pick up with the second half of Turok Dinosaur Hunter number 1.
Do you enjoy time travel in general and the Silver Age of comic books in particular? If so, join me each week on the Superman Fan Podcast. My name is Billy Hogan, and I will be your host. Together, we'll crash through the time barrier and fly into the past to explore the Silver Age adventures of Superman. One week, we will take a look at the Superman family of titles, Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen, World's Finest Comics, and soon, Superman's girlfriend Lois Lane. The next week, we will feature the Man of Steel's titles, Superman and Action Comics, which will include the Supergirl stories during her run in the back of that title. You can join me each week on Wednesday or Thursday at the supermanfanpodcast.blogspot.com, which is available on iTunes. And your emails are always welcome at supermanfanpodcast@gmail.com. And don't forget to wear your red indestructible cape.
And we're back. So continuing, barely alive, Turok crawls up on the shore, only to be met by a beautiful woman, and he immediately uses his best pickup line on her. "You're no beast." Look, I'm not saying it's a great pickup line. It's just the best he had. Okay. He takes refuge in a small Colombian village, slowly nursed back to health. But nearby, people are starting to wonder what's going on. The cocaine cartel has had its most recent convoy attacked by monsters. Back in the jungle, we learn that the Mother God has given Turok the ability to understand modern Spanish. Okay. As days pass, his strength returns. Sarita is gentle, her people generous and good. They're a farming community and don't quite understand his role as a hunter until he kills a jungle cat that was launching itself at her. Turok is lured into the jungle by dinosaur attacks, but he prepares to ambush the ambushers. But it's not an ambush, it's a diversion, because it turns out that Mr. and Mrs. Monarch are not the only dinos that came through the time warp, and they're heading straight to her village. "In the lost land, he destroyed my people. He seeks the same here." Turok battles his way back to the village, taking on raptor after raptor. He loses his arrows and then his knife. All he's left with is Mother God's empty bow, which happens to have an awesome surgical steel blade in it, because it was the 90s. Despite his victory, the villagers have a heart-to-heart with Turok. "Those creatures sought you. We must ask you to leave." Sarita chooses to stay with her people. She offers the hunter a bundle of arrows and her prayers. "I feel hollow. The battle was mine, but the triumph belongs to Monarch. For once again, I'm alone in this world, alone to wander, to remember, and to hunt." Now, I gotta admit, this wasn't as bad as I thought it would be. I mean, there's some real emotion, and there's a real story happening here.
But I'm going to line up with Tom on one thing here, because the one shot that I feel like he probably should have spent paid the most attention to is this almost full page shot of Turok and Sarita during the montage where he's recovering, and he looks terrible. His anatomy looks totally like off. And he's got Dudley Do-Right's jaw.
He does. And her superpower is keeping that dress on.
Well, get me some kryptonite then.
I agree with you. This was my first reaction was, wow, this wasn't as bad. The reputation this book has, I think, has to do with its role with regard to the speculation and crash of the market as opposed to the actual story contained within. There's you're fighting technologically enhanced dinosaurs. That's a pretty cool thing to fight, you know?
And, that's the thing. I think "not awful" is almost an unfair description of it. I think it's actually pretty decent.
Yeah. I mean,
It's not worth $350 in today's market, nevertheless, 20 years ago, but it's a decent read, and it makes me think, I wonder what happened in the next issue.
Dave Michelinie's a pro. I mean, he knows what he's doing. He's a real writer.
And it doesn't feel, even though it is somewhat decompressed, because you probably could have told the story in three pages, it doesn't feel decompressed when you read it.
No.
I seem to remember at the time when I was buying these that I thought Valiant's stories were much more entertaining than, say, Image's were. I remember thinking that a lot of Image was the art, but Valiant seemed to – not that the art was bad, but they seemed to invest a little bit more time in the stories, particularly with the Exo series I was very fond of. And Solar, I recall when they were coming out that I enjoyed the stories for Valiant, but I enjoyed the continual Rob Liefeld pushed eye candy from Image.
Was that part of Valiant's shtick? I know specifically that was Malibu's push. was that we hired the best writers. Was that somewhat Valiant as well? Or did it just sort of work out that way?
I thought that it just worked out that way. I mean, you spoke about Michelini. He was also writing the Harbinger book, he and Bob Layton, which that was a very award-winning pair for Marvel on, was it Iron Man?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That they really came, quote-unquote, to power as a duo. My feeling, even now when I go back and I'll read these books, Valiant just has a deeper feel as far as the storytelling to me than what Image from this same period does. Now, eventually Image gets over that, but, you know, still, this Turok came out in 93. Mm-hmm. So Image was still trying to, you know, feel its way. They were still creating this market that Turok was a part of, in my mind, and they were doing it a different way.
Yeah, I think that Image was clearly like they went under the banner of, you know, just creator owned and creator's rights, but it clearly seems like they were emphasizing the art over the story, because they were taking all of these you know, top named artists and giving them full creative control over their books. So I do think that there was certainly I can't speak for Valiant, but clearly Image was emphasizing art over story. I like that Image seemed to create they seemed to make a concerted effort to create a unified universe, you know, a la Marvel.
And the inner tension between them and Liefeld did not help things, but. And I think you're right about how this just kind of became Valiant's reputation, as opposed to Malibu, who actively sought out writers for creator-owned things. Layton and Michelini being the Iron Man team, who I believe were the Iron Man team when Shooter was the editor-in-chief still. So, I mean, maybe that is where, like, he was able to take a few people with him, or he still had some good relationships with some people. And that's where, because Valiant did have a reputation for being more solidly written in the Image, which is what the hype about Deathmate was, because it was like, okay, Valiant's writers and Image's artists, this is going to be good. And it didn't so much turn out that way, but they never seemed to set themselves up as, okay, we're the writer's house, as opposed to what the Ultraverse was being positioned out as, at least at first.
If Tom or Ed, if you guys had the opportunity, are you interested in finding out what happened next?
Yeah, it did enough to get me interested in what happened next issue, certainly.
I'm curious as to, because there's this one page interlude with this drug cartel.
Right.
With what is quite possibly one of the stupidest lines in the book. I've seen enough of the night, Carlos. Let's go inside and enjoy each other's darkness. Okay. But the whole idea is, like, you've got this drug cartel, and you know, because this is Colombia in the 80s.
The 80s, yeah.
Almost as if he compressed the story just a little bit, enough to give at least a little bit more light to that. Because that was one of the pieces I'm curious, because would that make it more complicated? Because right now, that's the one thing that makes me interested in, you know, like, what happens to the village, because he's obviously going to keep fighting these dinosaurs. It's in the title of the book, but, like, you know, how complicated are things going to get from here on out? So I am a little curious.
Yeah, potentially, you have three parties.
Oh yeah.
If you have Turok, the dinosaurs, and the cartel, and you could almost envision any two of them teaming up against the third. You have that baked into it, which is a nice thing to have here in issue one.
Which, to Michelini's credit, gives it more depth than had Liefeld or McFarlane or somebody been writing this. They probably wouldn't have done the cartel bit, and he would have walked off at the end with the – and if you didn't hear the sad music from the end of an episode of The Incredible Hulk playing, I certainly did. And it would have been way thinner. And it was just like adding that little subplot. I could have actually done without that the first a couple of pages in the beginning with all that Valiant universe recap stuff, because unless it's really, really central to the story, I didn't necessarily need it, but then again, you know, it's continuity. So
yeah, they were, yeah. And they were trying to build a universe.
Mm-hmm. And again, I'm not sure how much of that came from the prior incarnations of this character.
This is true.
Or if it's purely them trying to, you know, create basically a more in-depth universe or in-depth history that they might want to go back and explore more deeply down the road. I don't know. I mean, I'm unfamiliar with this series. I don't even know how long it ended up lasting.
47. It went until 1996, which probably, if I recall, what ended the series was that odd thing that happened to Valiant with Acclaim and Night Cieza and all that stuff that happened, that is that historical dividing point between like Valiant version 1 and Valiant 2.0.
Yeah, and the business end of Valiant Comics caught up to them eventually. Was anybody else? I think this is one of the reasons that I was never really gripped and drawn into Valiant when I first read a couple issues here and there in the early 90s. But the coloring on the book always threw me off. And I know this sounds odd, but like I was so used to having read DC, even though I had been reading DC on their, you know, kind of not so great newsprint paper, but also reading Image and some Marvel stuff. And the colors on those books, especially when they were on the better paper, popped a lot more. And there's a sort of, I don't even know how they were coloring it or how to describe it. It just looks in some places more washed out. And, you know, when I was 14, 15 or so, when this book came out, I think that was one of the things that would have been, because it looked different, it wouldn't, I don't think I would have liked it as much.
There is a certain muted feel to the color palette here. It's not muddy like some of the books are today or some of the books in the last 5 years have been. Just not a bright, like you say, the colors don't pop.
Yeah. It's not like a watercolor look to it. I can't describe it, but it's...
Watercolor is what keeps coming to mind for me. And mm-hmm. if thinking back, I don't know that I noticed it until you said something, Tom, but a lot of the Valiant books did seem to have the same technique, I guess, is what it would have to be.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah,
it was almost like a house look.
Yeah, as far as the coloring goes, to put you in mind of a Valiant book, if you just saw it, you could kind of really focus in and realize, oh, this must be one of Valiant's.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm not familiar with the work of Jorge Gonzalez, the colorist on this book, so I couldn't say if, you know, if this is his overall style or if it's the house style or what. But he's not a name I've seen that I can recall otherwise.
You know, if you look at some of the house ads that are in here, I think it's fairly similar, or at least the same.
No, yeah, I could pull the two Valiant Deathmate piece books off the shelf right now and probably see the same coloring process being used.
That's interesting. I mean, that is one of the areas where there was some experimentation. There was Malibu famously had supposedly the best coloring process. One of the stories is that's why Marvel wanted them.
Yeah, I think it was one of the earliest and were at least more one of the more first very forward computerized coloring processes on Malibu's part.
Well, they certainly didn't buy them to produce comics with their characters for the long run.
They probably still own them too.
Oh, I'm sure they do, but my speculation is that every one of those characters has a certain amount that has to go back to the creator if they're produced, and Marvel just says, why bother?
I mean, that is one of the disadvantages of a creator-owned book like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And technically, it's not even creator-owned because Marvel owns them now.
Right.
But
I think some of those contracts...
Yeah. The royalties, yeah.
The royalties under which that was one of the draws of the indies. Is you get to own at least a percentage or have that higher royalty rate.
And it's a shame, too, because they had a decent, not great, but decent character stable that in an industry where the big two are not creating new characters at any level any longer, it would be nice to get an infusion of new characters in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You would almost think, and it's similar to the discussion that I know we've had in the past about ROM and Micronauts and things like that. Like, you would think it's almost worth their while to say, hey, I'll take a little less on my kickback if you do use the character, because at least then I'm getting something.
Yeah, I mean, whatever the percentage is, that big percentage of zero.
Yeah, exactly.
Versus a smaller percentage of $500 million.
Well, you're right, and there's precedence for this, because that's essentially what Marv Wolfman and George Perez and a couple other people had to do to get Crisis on Infinite Earths collected, because one of the things that held that up for years was the fact that DC, because of the way their contracts had been written, DC had to pay them a certain amount of money, and from what I understand, they actually took a loss on the first hardcover, probably just made it back, because that's been – when it got into trade, it's been reprinted. It might still be in print, actually, and there's been an absolute edition and stuff. So there are models to go by where something like that has worked. You know, if you can prove that this has – you know, I don't know if Prime or Rune or anything like that has the interest, but – they might be able to put it out, take a loss, and then gain that money back with a little bit of longevity.
But as with the conversation I know I heard Alan and Scott had on their ROM episode, you don't know if there's any kind of also further hands in the pot for if movie rights were sold, or if any other company has their fingers in this thing, and maybe they would prevent it from financially being produced.
Yeah, I'm just waiting till Disney owns everything.
Yeah.
I just don't mean in entertainment. I mean everything.
Well, we may see it in our lifetime.
You might be right, though. With ROM, it is like, who originally put ROM out? Was it like Parker Brothers or somebody?
Yeah.
Which is now owned by Hasbro.
Okay. But I think part of the issue might be that the original inventors, creators of the ROM toy, and now their estates perhaps, still have a little bit of a percentage and have some rights, have at least some veto rights.
And it's possible that there's a similar between the creators of the Malibu characters and everybody else, that there's like three or four different people who you have to pay in order to put out a trade of Prime, or which is the one Malibu book that I stuck with the longer than the other ones, or with Barry Windsor Smith and Rune and all these things. Yeah.
To some extent, I have hope, because they've just worked that out in the DVD world. Because for the longest time, there were some shows, especially from the 80s, where because of the soundtrack issues, producing the DVDs became prohibitively expensive. Because of all the rights issues involved with that, they could not have made DVDs at a profitable rate because of how much would have had to get paid to every songwriter and every performer on every episode of whatever the show would be.
Way down the line in another one of my shows, I'm going to be covering talking about China Beach, which is basically one of those shows where that had happened.
My
music rights and stuff. The Wonder Years
show,
is a great example.
Yeah, Wonder Years is the great example. And they solved that, because that just got released very recently.
If you guys are really interested in the Malibu side of things, the Facebook page that has been set up by fans initially – several of the Malibu creators are also fans of the page. So as we would say, discuss this in posts, they'll jump in and throw in, you know, the actual information
on the Ultraverse page.
Ultraverse. Well,
Valiant has relaunched in the last couple of years.
Right.
I mean, I kind of glance through it in the back of previews when I'm, you know, looking at previews each month. But I'm surprised I haven't seen more collections and stuff on the level of what DC and Marvel has put out of 80s and 90s stuff in the last few years from somebody like Valiant. I don't know if they've got the ability to do that or who's got. I know they can publish the characters, but is the old material still available or what?
I don't know if the old material would be financially beneficial to them to try and put out trades at this point. I don't know if there's, I don't know if the resurgence of Valiant has reached a level yet to make people go back and get trades and reprinted issues just yet.
No, it's been very quiet. They've been overshadowed by companies like IDW and Boom and their rise over the last 5 to 10 years.
And it seems like a lot of that has been on licensed characters.
It's very low, very, very licensed heavy.
So before we put a final capper on the issue, let's hear from our guests about where we can find their shows and their blogs and all of that stuff. So let's start over in West Virginia with Ed.
A couple easy ways to find the podcast that I'm involved in. You can look at the Comic Book Noise website. Or if you spend more time on Facebook, you can look up the Teal Productions Facebook page. Either of those will have the episodes that I do that come out. I do several comic book podcasts, and I do one that's not comic book related. But if you watch those areas close enough, you'll see my name come through without me having to tell everybody all the unfortunate number of podcasts that I do. Just keep your eyes open and you'll be able to see the ones I'm attached to.
But hypothetically, what would some of those podcasts be?
Hypothetically, if I were to do a podcast, I would do perhaps a Mighty Thor podcast with my wife, Terry. I also am interested in Green Arrow. So if I did a Green Arrow podcast, I would call it the Emerald Archer and encourage my son to do that with me. I would perhaps do a podcast centered on Usagi Yojimbo entitled Ronin Rabbit. With any spare time that I have, I might also do a DC Dr. Fate fan podcast entitled Lords of Order. And then going way back to the beginnings of my comic book reading, I could discuss the Marvel Bronze Age with my brother. But all of those are hypothetical if I had time to do podcasting, which I don't.
Now, do you have any friends to talk about comics with, or is it all family members?
Yes, I do. I have plenty of friends to talk comic books with. There's a cool podcast that I am familiar with called Short Box Showcase.
Hey! Mr. Paul Spataro, where can we find you? Hanging out on what corner and which intersection?
My primary podcasting is done on Back to the Bins, where I co-host along with Bill Robinson and Scott Gardner, and we look back on random old comics and generally have a fun time finding tangents to talk about. An offshoot of that is Avengers Spotlight, where we try to focus on Avengers characters and Avengers books. I also do a bi-weekly podcast where we're going episode by episode through the Star Trek series Deep Space Nine called Listen to the Prophets. And then because I seem to have too much free time, I've been appearing semi-regularly on the Two Guys Talking Network, where I've been occasionally co-hosting, reviewing episodes of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and Peggy Carter.
I'm loving that show.
As am I.
What it's worth, yes. Mr. Tom Panarese, what do you do and where can we find it?
I have two podcasts, one being In Country. That is a podcast where I am taking an issue-by-issue look at the Marvel Comics series, The Nom, and have a few special episodes here and there where I cover movies related to the Vietnam War. I've done some books and stuff. And that is, right now is in about issue, I think I'm in about issue 39, 40 issue of the series. So I'm almost about halfway through on the run of the series. That's over at Two True Freaks. And my main podcast is Pop Culture Affidavit, The Sworn Testimony of a Dork, which is basically a bi-weekly, two-monthly episode podcast where I more or less talk about whatever I would like to in the world of popular culture, movies, music, TV, comics. One sort of mini-series within the series of that that's going on this year is called 80 Years of DC Comics, where each month I'm taking a look at a genre of DC Comics that has been published over the course of its 80 years that is not a superhero comic. So actually about a week or two before recording this podcast, I released an episode where Stella from the Batgirl to Oracle podcast and I sat down and went through an old romance comic, and I'll be covering Western and action adventure and sci-fi and some other stuff.
That episode humor. With Stella was a total hoot to listen to.
It was so much fun to do too. That comic was so, so,
so crazy.
So nuts. But you can find that at Two True Freaks, and you can the site for that, because Pop Culture Affidavit is not just a podcast, it's a blog, and I post in essays when I'm not doing podcast episodes at popcultureaffidavit.com.
Great. Thanks, guys. Really appreciate you joining me. Fun podcast, okay. Fun episode, fun discussion. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for
thank you.
To be on. I
thank
really
you.
Enjoyed it.
It was a great time.
The verdict on Turok Dinosaur Hunter number 1? Well, not as bad as I thought it might be, to be honest. And although the consequences of the boom and bust cycle, which this issue was a major part of, were more harmful than helpful to the comics industry, comic book stores for sure, and even us as readers, one positive effect was, let's be honest, cheap bins. There are books in the quarter bins around here that aren't all from this era, but I wonder if there weren't so many overproduced books coming out in the 90s, if there would be regular quarter bin sales at my LCS, or 25-cent clearance boxes at a bunch of the half-price bookstores near me. Maybe without this book, this podcast wouldn't be here. And for that alone, Turok Dinosaur Hunter number 1 is an official quarter bin steal. And trust me, you can probably find it for around that price at a comic store near you. That wraps up our coverage of Turok Dinosaur Hunter number 1, bringing episode 50 of the Quarter Bin Podcast to a close. In episode 51, if the timing of this episode works out how I think it will, there's a very good chance that we'll be looking at books from this year's Free Comic Book Day. This episode contains only the first hour or so of what was a much longer conversation. After talking about this issue itself, we went on for well over an hour about the boom and bust of the 90s, the future of the comics industry, etc., all of which flowed directly from our discussion of this book. That conversation will come out as the next item in the Relatively Geeky feed, but it won't be a quarter bin episode, because that part of the conversation was not about a specific comic. So it's actually going to be released as just Relatively Geeky Presents, probably episode 3. But if you're listening to this on its first run, within the first week of this episode being released, then it'll just be the next item in the Relatively Geeky feed. That conversation is not a necessary sequel to this episode. It's not mandatory. But if you want to hear the four of us and the Irredeemable Shag talk about the state of the comic book industry from the 90s onward, listen to that episode. If you have any questions or comments about this issue or the podcast, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the quarter bin. The Quarter Bin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening.
Well, I wouldn't be so sure. I'm trying
what
to see
could if possibly go wrong.
And on my end, I also do pretty heavy editing. So if you stumble, you know, just, you know, get start over at the start of a sentence. If we talk over each other, we'll just back it up and start again.
Okay.
I'm not used to levels of professionalism like that.
Well, I just released episode 45, and this is episode 50. So I gave myself plenty of room,
plenty of time.
And that's, of course, if all our Skypes crash and we have to do it again. There's always that. Probably am going to talk next week to Shag. I did want to get his input because he was actually working retail at a comic shop during this era. So I did want to, even though he had some, I don't know, mumbo jumbo family stuff. Definitely wanted to get his take.
Priorities, people.
What is up with that?
So 25 cents for this one, huh?
Well worth it. Does yours have the sticker on it? Does it have the sticker on it, Paul?
It has the sticker, and I will never remove that sticker. But somehow I ended up with a second copy of this now. Because Ron Sadowski sent a Christmas care package, and in it there was a Valiant sampler, you know, one of those sealed plastic bags with four books in it, and happened to be one of them. Yeah. So I went from having none to having two.
Well, I know that Ed has a story to tell because he already had this book in his collection. He has some explaining to do. That's all I'm saying, Ed.
That's all I'm saying.
And I went to my LCS to get it, and I may have paid 50 cents for it. I can't remember because I just bought it in a big pile of comics, so I can't remember what I paid. But he had like 12 of them.
Well, the sad thing, and maybe we should save this for the show, but the sad thing is that you spent like $2.80 to mail it to me.
Yeah, I'm not even going to mention the one comic I mailed to Andy. That was a bad move.
Yeah, well, that's when I sent the package to Andy, I made a point of loading it up a lot.
I probably should have put 10 in here. Because the postage to send him one comic, but
the amount they charge for overseas shipping is ridiculous.
So that quarter book cost me, I don't know, about $12, I think, total to send it to him. But, you know, I'm getting the podcast karma.
Yeah, there's your return on investment.
There you go. I mean, what else were you going to do, Paul? Well, I mean, no wonder you're here. You got nowhere else to go.
Without Dr. Bill here, I have to take on both personas. I'm thinking you only invited me so that you'd have somebody older than you in the group.
It was a stretch, but...
Because there's only, you know, if nothing else, I'm part of a select group because there's not that many people who are older than you out there who podcast.
Ed is in my demographic. I'm pretty sure Ed's in my demographic.
Yeah, I'll be...
Based on the age of his kid.
I'll be 48 in a month and a half or so.
I think that puts you third on this list out of four.
This year's the big 5-0 for me.
Oh, okay.
So I'm pretty sure
Tom... I'm looking at 5-0 in my rearview mirror.
so Tom is picking up the tab as the young kid here.
I'll be 38 in June.
Shut up. I hate you. I'll be 38 14 years ago.
when we get to the part where we're talking about collecting comics in the 90s, it actually will work to my advantage because this is when I was a teenager. So, but I'll save that for that part because I was thinking about this today.
Your answer to any questions that come out are, I was a teenager. What's your excuse?
Exactly.
It's like everybody experiments in college.
I just recorded with Tom a couple of weeks ago, so I'm used to this professional setup now. He gets right to it. I mean, you're on Back to the Bins 4 or 5 times. Whew, you don't even know what to expect. Anyway.
Well, Tom's been on Back to the Bins twice now.
You go.
Yeah.
Catching up on me. All right. Law.
Yeah. Well, on the Valiant side of things, Shooter himself, I stopped following it a couple years ago because he stopped updating on a regular basis. But he, for a while, or... his assistant, Janet Jackson, not that one. If they were posting a lot of old archival stuff from both Marvel and Valiant, mostly Marvel though, and it was like all internal memos, like all this stuff that he had saved. Right. And he was giving his side of the story, and I remember a friend of I and I were discussing like all of the details he was putting into this stuff, and I was like, is he writing a book and we don't know about it, or was he? Because it seriously looked like it had all been saved, and the way he was putting out was like he'd been compiling a book somewhere and he was going to be putting a book out, but nothing has ever come of it. And he did have some Valiant stuff up there and here and there, at least for the first part of the company. I know there's a lot of bad blood between him and some of the people, a lot of the people he's dealt with.